All right.
The Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God bless the state of Texas and this Honorable Court.
Thank you. Be seated, please. Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket today. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 070284, City of Dallas versus Kenneth E. Albert and others from Collin County and the 5th Court of Appeals District. And that will be consolidated for argument with 070288, City of Dallas versus David Martin and others from Rockwall County and the 5th Court of Appeals District. Docket number 071042, ERI Consulting Engineers and Larry Snodgrass versus J. Mark Swinia, Beatty Environmental, Inc., and Malneba Company, Limited from Smith County and the 12th Court of Appeals District, and 080592, Fresh Coat, Inc. versus K2, Inc., from Montgomery County and the 9th Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side for each of these arguments, and we will take a brief recess between them. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in the consolidated City of Dallas cases 070284 and 070288.
May it please the court, Ms. Hankinson will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. When this court requested briefs on the merits in these cases, it asked the city and the plaintiffs to brief the issues that remain in light of Heinrich. The city's briefs show that, with the exception of the statutory issue remanded by the Court of Appeals in accordance with this court's remand orders in similarly postured cases, Heinrich controls the disposition of the remaining issues. The result is that governmental immunity bars the plaintiff's declaratory judgment claims against the city, and plaintiffs cannot assert an ultra-virus claim against the city and has no ultra-virus claim against city officials. These are the issues I would like to discuss with the court during my allotted time. First, with respect to the plaintiff's declaratory judgment claims against the city of Dallas, here is the posture of these cases. The city is the only defendant. The only claim remaining before this court is one that is sought alternatively, a construction of City Ordinance 16084 and its effect on the plaintiff's employment contract with the city. There is no challenge to the validity of a city ordinance. Heinrich dictates that governmental immunity bars these claims for the following reasons.
Well, Heinrich didn't involve a challenge to the pension plan language itself. It was more application of the pension language to Heinrich, right?
Correct.
And why is that different from here? All they're seeking is a declaration of what this ordinance means. They're not challenging the ordinance itself.
Your Honor, that's correct. And the point is that they are challenging the way the city has paid them under what they say is a contract that arose as a result of the ordinance. And under this court's jurisprudence with respect to declaratory judgment actions, the court must look at the substance of the claims to determine whether a declaratory judgment action is proper.
But would you agree that it's the exact same situation as Heinrich in terms of the firefighters are seeking a determination of what the statute means? They're not challenging the validity of the statute.
I agree with that. They are not challenging the validity of that. The court, in its Heinrich analysis on the declaratory judgment aspects, began with the well-established principle that under Texas law, the Declaratory Judgment Act does not enlarge a trial court's jurisdiction, and a litigant's request for declaratory relief does not change a suit's underlying nature. It is merely a procedural device. The second principle that the court recognized from well-established Texas law is that immunity applies to suits for both declaratory and injunctive relief. And this is because this court has previously determined that both declaratory and injunctive relief can interfere with the government's exercise of its discretion.
Did we in Heinrich foreclose any kind of remedy for plaintiffs in this position? I mean, let's say that there's a little bit of dispute about this, but the ordinance guarantees this sort of structure and pay for life for these firefighters, and that's what the city, the residents wanted, and that's what the ordinance adopted. And then the city simply won't comply with that. Let's just assume that's the case. What remedy would they ever have if there's no suit against the city to enforce it, and if you're saying there's no ultra-virus claim?
Well, Your Honor, there is no ultra-virus. In Heinrich, the court held that there is no ultra-virus claim against the government itself,
right,
and against the city.
But you're saying even in the future there's no ultra-virus claim against any city officials?
There's no ultra-virus claim. First of all, the city officials aren't here. But there is no ultra-virus claim against the city officials, because the standard for that is whether they have acted without legal authority. The ordinance, which flowed from the referendum, is not anything that grants authority. The authority in which the police officers and firefighters are paid is by virtue of the state statute that gives to home rule cities the authority to make appropriations, and then the city code and city regulations that deal with how those appropriations are to be made. The appropriation of money has always been discretionary in Texas. What we have here is a challenge to the way the city has appropriated money to pay.
But to explore this a little bit, if the ordinance were very, very clear and said, this shall be the structure for pay, and whoever writes the checks at the city, I don't know, the city treasurer, there's got to be a person who does that. He just says, I think that's bad policy. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to write the checks. Would there be an action in that case?
Would there be no action against the city?
Right.
If, in fact, there was something that in the appropriations, the legal authority to make appropriations, that curtailed the discretion of the city with respect to that, which is contrary to everything in Texas law about the appropriations process at the city, local, and state levels. But presuming that that would be the case, then under Heinrich, if there really was a situation in which he was acting outside his legal authority by not doing what he was supposed to, then under Heinrich, the remedy would be prospective injunctive relief, and that's all.
And that would be the case whether he were doing it on his own or whether he had the acquiescence of the council to.
That's correct.
And you'd sue the council or other people, but if it were that clear, then you could require it. So what's the difference between that and this?
The difference between that and this, Your Honor, is that this particular ordinance does not in any way address the authority of the city with respect to how appropriations are made. No legal authority flows from this. And as a result of that, it falls in the category of cases, a long line of cases that this court has had, in which the court has said that it is not ultra-virus for a public official to misinterpret the law. It is not ultra-virus for a public official to make a mistake or to do something wrong.
Let's take the differential out. Let's say the ordinance had just said there shall be a raise. Would your answer be the same?
It would be the same.
Because there's always going to be budgetary discretionary
authority? Yes. Every governmental entity in Texas has the discretion and the control over appropriations. And there is a state statute with respect to cities that says that, and then you have all of the procedures within the code and the ordinances of the City of Dallas which say how that process is to be undertaken. So your remedy is going to always have to just be the prospective injunctive relief if it really is ultra-virus. This is not ultra-virus even if there were city officials here, but they are not here. The only thing that's before the court is the declaratory judgment action.
But how is that different than from Heinrich? Because wouldn't those same appropriative sort of issues come into play?
The Heinrich statute is different. It specifically has in it the legal authority granted to the board to deal with the amounts to be paid. I mean, it is the authorizing statute. And what it says in there, it provides some limitations on that. It says they can make adjustments. They just can't reduce. Now, query, that's described in the court's opinion as being ministerial, a ministerial function in that regard, but the difference between the two schemes is that's the source of the legal authority, which is why you can say it is outside the legal authority because no authority was given to reduce. That's different than this scheme, looking at the language of this ordinance now, as well as the other statutory scheme with respect to appropriations.
Now, is the... With respect to kind of the different kinds of ordinances that we were talking about, what about the 15% in the ordinance?
It's the same thing, Your Honor.
If this passed and the city said, well, we're not going to give the 15%, there's nothing that can be done about that.
No. There is something that can be done, Your Honor, because there is, in fact, an administrative procedure which we've briefed for the court in which that can be raised.
Right, but ultimately, if the treasurer said or the city council that this passed, but we're not going to pay the 15%, they're immune from suit in that situation.
I think they are, Your Honor. I think they have to follow the other procedures that are in place. They are not without a remedy. And I think they have, which is why we brief that for the court. They have to follow the other procedures that are in place. That's the whole point of immunity, is that the legislature gets to control what the remedies are and what the limitations are.
Why didn't you waive immunity from suit by filing a counterclaim? And does jurisdiction come and go based on what sorts of pleadings you file?
It does not, Your Honor. And we did not waive jurisdiction with the counterclaim that was filed for several reasons, including going back to the very language of RIATA. RIATA sets up, the plaintiffs make procedural construct arguments and try to equate this to a lot of procedural mechanisms. I would suggest to the court that that's not appropriate in a sovereign immunity case and certainly would be inconsistent with what the court said in RIATA. I think that the court's jurisprudence on sovereign immunity is what addresses the question of what happens under these circumstances. First of all, there is not anything in RIATA in which this court said that by filing the counterclaim there was a waiver of immunity by conduct. It is not in the opinion. It would be inconsistent with this court's jurisprudence, which has consistently said that legislative enactment and legislative resolution are the way that immunity is waived. Second of all,
there's no legal effect to filing that counterclaim and basically becoming a party to that suit. It's of no legal consequence as it relates to immunity. Is that right?
Well, at the time that it was filed, first of all, there's a question about this counterclaim. The RIATA construct with respect to claims made and the extent to which, as the court says, the sphere or the boundaries of immunity are altered as a result of it. Immunity does not go away. So if it really was a defensive counterclaim and an offset, then the sphere of immunity, according to the language of the opinion, changed. It didn't go away. And there would be an offset with respect to the city's counterclaim. Now, that counterclaim was not defensive, and it was not an offset, so it doesn't come within the language. But here's what the court has said in the opinion, which I think is important, at page 377. The court says that when the City of Dallas in that suit filed a claim It encompassed a decision to leave its sphere of immunity from suit for claims against it which are germane to, connected with, and properly defensive to the claims the city asserts. But then the court said this: the city continues to have immunity from affirmative damage claims against it for monetary relief exceeding amounts necessary to offset the city's claims. The immunity did not go away.
So the it was still there outside the sphere.
Then the court went on to say, absent the legislature's waiver of the city's immunity from suit, however, the trial court did not acquire jurisdiction over a claim for damages against the city in excess of damages sufficient to offset the city's recovery. Immunity did not go away. Immunity does not come and go. And it didn't come and go there. If the counterclaim, while it was pending, did fall within the category that specified in Riata, which we don't think it did, then for a while there was a sphere within which there was not immunity for offset purposes. And that's it. But the language of the opinion controls that. Now we are left with a circumstance in which there is nothing to offset. It's gone. And because the opinion says that immunity continued and that immunity exists outside the extent of the offset, if we're down to zero, then immunity cloaks the whole case again.
Sounds like your argument is that the governmental entity can affect or determine the contours of the sphere of immunity by its litigation actions.
I think that was the language that this court used in its opinion.
That's how you interpret Riata?
Yes, sir.
Let me ask you about House Bill 1473. 2007 that waived immunity for these kinds of cases, not this case.
Right.
Doesn't that indicate legislative intent that there should that the government should not be immune from these kinds of lawsuits?
No, Your Honor. What it was, I think that statute, that's 311.034. I'm sorry, not 311.03. It's 180.05 now.
06, yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. 06.
Yeah.
No, Your Honor, this was a reaction. This came after the Williams decision by this court. And it does indicate, it is exactly what the legislature does when it decides to waive immunity. Sometimes it just says we waive, and other times it does, like here, and set parameters and limitations, which it does. But what it reflects is that because there was no waiver of immunity for any of these kinds of claims before this was passed, what the court did in this particular provision in Section G was preserve the immunity that already existed for the City of Dallas with respect to the claims the plaintiffs are making here. So this evidences the intent on the part of the legislature to leave the status quo, which means that these claims are subject to governmental immunity, and the legislature indicated its clear intent that there was to be no waiver of immunity with respect to these claims.
Any further questions? Thank you, Ms. Hankinson. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondents.
The court, Mr. McGarry and Mr. Parsley will present argument for the respondents. Mr. McGarry will open with the first 8 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court. I will be addressing our contention that the doctrine of governmental immunity cannot applied to a lawsuit that's seeking to enforce an ordinance enacted by voter referendum. Mr. Parsley will be addressing the remaining issues regarding the various waivers of immunity that might also apply to this case. The Dallas City Charter expressly provides for the adoption of ordinances by voter referendum and also expressly provides that any ordinance passed by a vote of the people cannot be repealed or amended except by another vote of the people. This case, at its very core, is a case seeking to enforce an ordinance passed by voter referendum and also to invalidate subsequent pay resolutions adopted by the City Council to the extent that they are inconsistent with the requirements of that referendum.
That make it a suit for just money damages, though,
ultimately? No, Your Honor, one distinction that we're going to be asking this court to recognize, which the court has already recognized in another case, is that not all claims for money are claims for money damages, that there's a difference between seeking indeterminate money damages under a common law theory of tort or contract and seeking a sum of money that has been specifically ordered by the legislature. And in this case, the legislature that passed the policy regarding payment in this case is the citizen legislature, the electorate acting as the sovereign in this case. And I think that makes this case fall outside of any case that this court's ever addressed before, because we're dealing with a case in which the city is essentially asserting immunity against the sovereign.
How much money are we talking about?
Really, I know there's been media reports about a large sum of money. There is no allegation of a specific sum of money, and there is no evidence in this case of a specific sum of money. And
well, roughly. I mean, the we're talking billions or in the briefs here.
I would say it is a large sum of money, but honestly, there is no evidence of it, so it would be purely speculation. And also, I would point out that obviously this is an interlocutory appeal. It does not address the
merits
of the case.
Let's assume it's $1 billion that that is at issue here. And the city would, if we were to rule in that way, would have to write a check for $1 billion. What would happen if the city just doesn't have the money? What if there's a budgetary crisis? If you know, there's a natural disaster and the city has to react to that. I mean, what? How are the current officials supposed to handle that sort of thing without some kind of discretion not to pay if public policy requires something?
Let me address that this way. Number one, the policy decision, and I'm getting kind of ahead of myself in my argument, but we're asking the court to adopt a black letter rule which says that government immunity does simply not apply to a suit seeking payment from a city where the city's own legislature has ordered the payment. The policy decision as to whether and how to spend money has been made by the legislature, because in this case, unique among all the cases the court has considered, the legislature is the electorate.
But there's nothing about appropriative authority in the ordinance. So are you saying that the ordinance usurps the city's appropriative authority?
No, well, it's not really usurp. It is the city's appropriative authority. The electorate in this case has the power to make that appropriation, and it did. It made that policy decision that the city should be required to make these payments to its police officers and firefighters in a specific proportion. Now, I would also point out that one of the public policies supporting a grant of immunity is the notion that one legislature for a government body should not be bound by the decisions of a prior legislature. But a referendum is unique in that it is the specific purpose of a referendum to bind subsequent legislatures.
Well, let me ask
that's
you
the specific requirement of the charter, that the city council cannot just thereafter amend any ordinance that's been passed by a referendum. They don't have that power.
Your argument presumes that this ordinance is crystal clear in terms of the pay differentials, and I think you'd have to concede that it's really not crystal clear.
Well, that's the merits of the case, and we're conceding that even if the court says there's no immunity in this case, that the city might well have zero liability.
Well, let me get back to my question. Presuming the ordinance is unclear in that regard, shouldn't we afford a certain amount of discretion to the appropriative body as to what it requires?
No, and I'll say this, because what you're again assuming is that the council is the appropriative body and not the citizens. What you're dealing with here is a normal case of statutory construction. You have to find the intent of the legislature, but you have to keep in mind that the legislature whose intent you are required to enforce is the citizen legislature and not the city council. It's their intent that governs this case.
What if you have a school over here, Council?
Excuse me.
What if you have a school district that forecasts, the voters forecast that there is going to be this huge growth in school children, and so we said we've got to have a referendum for $1 billion bond, and so the people vote that. They vote the bond.
And so they turn out to be wrong?
Turn out to be wrong.
It requires another referendum. The people have to admit their mistake.
In the absence of another referendum, they would be compelled, in your opinion, to build the schools that will be empty.
That's the clear requirement of the law. That's the city charter says that in this case. says that the City Council does not have the power to amend or modify or repeal a law passed by the voters. They have that. They do not have that power. Now, getting back on track, and we've covered a couple of my points here, but the rule we're asking, there's four compelling reasons to adopt this black letter rule. Number one, it's consistent with all the policies that have ever been stated in support of immunity. Number two, cases involving legislative entitlement to payment do not properly fit in the framework of an ultra vires lawsuit. Number three, that to hold otherwise would construe legislation requiring the entitlement to payment to be ineffective. You'd be reading the statute to be a nullity if you were to say that the city was free to disregard it.
But that's what immunity does.
Yes, and that we're saying here, though, that the electorate is the sovereign. The court's faced with a catch-22. To apply immunity to this case to any degree, even as a bar of retroactive relief versus prospective relief, you're actually undermining the sovereign. You're not supporting the sovereign because, in this case, the people are the sovereign.
But the, one of the enlightened reasons for immunity is to protect the government from improvident decisions, and the populace is no more immune from improvident decisions than their elected representatives.
Yes, but you have to understand, too, that ultimately, it's the people who always pay for improvident decisions, and in this case, they have no one to blame but themselves. They can't blame the city council. They can't vote them out. It wouldn't make any difference. The city has always had the option of calling another referendum.
Well, let's backtrack there. I'm going to go back to just your screen scenario. This might not be exactly on point with your situation. But you said we can't vote them out. Why wouldn't that be a remedy?
Excuse me?
You said that they cannot vote them out. Why isn't that a remedy?
Well, but it wouldn't provide a remedy.
If there's no money to build schools after a referendum was passed, or in this situation, no money to follow this legislation or this ordinance, why isn't the remedy to get someone else to follow it, vote people out of office?
Well, it would be simply to enforce the law. I mean, that's what we're asking the court to do, in essence, is please, just enforce the law, and if that requires the city to pass a bond or to borrow money, or to do whatever it has to do to pay what the law requires, that's simply all we're asking the court to do is compel a specific performance of the referendum. That's all we're asking. We're not asking for indeterminate money damages. We're asking simply for what the law requires. After the trial court and any reviewing courts determine exactly what it is that the law does require in this case.
And without consideration of the potential consequence.
Excuse me?
And without consideration of the potential consequence.
Yeah, because you're looking at the merits in this case, and again, that's not before the court. That's going to be another issue that come up on second round as to what did in fact the referendum require this proportion to be kept indefinitely. That's a separate issue.
Further questions? Thank you.
Thank
Council.
You.
Mr. Parsons.
Good morning. May it please the court. I am, as Mr. McGarry said, going to address the waiver issues, but I'm going to take a brief aside for the waiver issues to talk about Heinrich just for a moment. The city has argued to you, I believe, that we could not possibly have an ultra vires claim here under any circumstances anyway. The court must, I think, in light of that argument, look to the city's live pleading at the time that this appeal happened, which is the Albert Clerk's record starting on page 69 and specifically page 84 and a few pages after that, where the city plainly pleads that if their pay of these firefighters has not complied with the ordinance, then their resolutions paying the firefighters over the years are, quote, ultra vires, illegal and void. The city pleads that they have committed ultra vires acts. Now the question is how does Heinrich play in, particularly if the city, Heinrich says that you must sue officials for ultra vires acts because a city, a government, cannot act ultra vires. But what happens if the government has admitted that it acted ultra vires? Does Heinrich apply at all? But clearly, we have a claim for ultra vires acts, I believe, under the city's own pleadings in this case. As to waiver, I'd like to talk about that through the lens of history, if I may.
The problem, of course, with Heinrich and the ultra vires declaratory judgment construct is you don't know whether jurisdiction exists until the case is over.
That is a problem with Heinrich. And I think if I talk about, if my conversation with you a bit on waiver, I think, may address that a bit also. Here's where the way I think the court needs to look at waiver and needs to look at immunity more broadly, and it affects Heinrich, and that is in the context of history. The United States government is a sovereign government, and it enjoys immunity from suit because of its sovereignty. The state of Texas is a sovereign government, except to the extent it's given it some sovereignty to the United States government under the Constitution. Sovereignty implicates immunity from suit because the concept is that by being sovereign, you don't have to answer to anyone for anything. That is sovereignty, as Justice Jefferson has noted in one of his opinions, quoting the Federalist Papers. Sovereignty means you don't answer to anyone. So the state doesn't have to answer to its citizens in court. The state doesn't even have to go to court. It just has to show up and say, we're the state, we are sovereign, we are not required to answer to anyone. It's inherent in sovereignty. A municipality, as the United States Supreme Court said in Alden versus Maine, and this court has recognized forever, is not sovereign in and of itself. It is not a sovereign government. It is partly private, and it is partly public. Now, this court has extended immunity from suit to cities, and it has done so for prudential reasons, for practical reasons. It has said for practical reasons a city is like the state and ought to be able to control its own budget. But a city's immunity from suit under this court's jurisprudence is prudential immunity from suit, practical immunity from suit. And if there's practical immunity from suit, there is practical waiver of immunity from suit. The question is, because it's not sovereign immunity, you have said over and over it's governmental immunity, and that's the key difference between the two. It's the difference between immunity that arises because of sovereignty and immunity that has been granted by the common law for prudential reasons.
And I take it you base your reasoning in this regard on City of Galveston versus State of Texas, where we said the city had immunity.
The City of Galveston, as Justice Brister said in that case, immunity derives from the common law, not through the state. That's exactly right. And you, of course, joined in Justice Willett's dissent on that, and noting correctly, I believe Justice Willett did, that sovereignty gives rise to immunity from suit. So that's right. Galveston, if read that way, confirms exactly what I'm saying. The difference between sovereign immunity and governmental immunity is the difference between sovereignty and being partly public, partly private, like a municipality
well,
is.
If practicality is the touchstone, what could be more practical than trying to come up with a budget and the appropriation process?
Nothing.
Quintessentially the immunity you're talking about?
Absolutely. That's a very practical consideration, but also practically speaking is it means that you don't have to inextricably tie governmental immunity to subject matter jurisdiction, as sovereign immunity might be tied inextricably to subject matter jurisdiction. You don't have to, so subject matter jurisdiction is not the problem it is for governmental immunity that it is for sovereign immunity. And the second thing it tells you is that practical considerations ought to be considered in waiver. When the city comes to court on purpose, joins the case, and litigates for 9 years before telling a court, by the way, you don't have control over me. That is, we believe, an example of practical waiver. It is accessing the state's court system for its own purposes until it's tired of accessing the state's court system for its own purposes, in which case it says, you can't hold me any longer. It is accepting the benefits of the bargain potentially from these firefighters. They performed during the period of time that this ordinance was in place and they were supposed to be paid a certain amount of money. They have fully performed their obligations, and this court has noted that performance may be a waiver by conduct. It is also a waiver by conduct, as we know, just the filing of the counterclaim is a waiver by conduct. This court has so held. This court has held in Anderson-Clayton case that the state can waive immunity, not just a lower authority, but the state can waive immunity by litigating.
Even if that were the case, would RIATA still apply to the extent that they would only be in the suit for a limited purpose?
I think that the court really needs to think about whether that is good public policy to say that you're only in that immunity can be partly here and partly not. Jurisdiction is partly here and partly not. It's a little bit like being pregnant. Either a court has jurisdiction or it doesn't. And that's what immunity from suit contemplates is jurisdiction. Either
well, like
it has
said,
jurisdiction.
I thought you just got through saying that it's prudential in regard to governmental immunity, and there's a difference between the city waiving and the state waive it.
There is.
We don't allow the city to waive, do we?
I think the city can waive. I think for prudential reasons, the city can waive. Whether the state can waive...
Yeah, we said it gets outside its sphere of immunity. So basically, I think opposing counsel said we kind of altered the parameters of the immunity. But there's a problem with the city going out and in. I can see that. But why do we not do as opposing counsel said, and we just allow them a certain amount of non-immunity when they go into it?
Well,
it's prudential. You just got through saying it's prudential, and it seems like that would be a very prudential decision.
Well, it is. If it's a prudential decision, you can do many things. But I still think that you must look at it through the lens of history. You must understand, I think, that sovereign immunity can be is a jurisdictional concept because the sovereign doesn't have to answer to anyone. But the city does have to answer to someone. And
the city's governmental immunity. That's you're making the distinction.
That's right. So they are there asserting their governmental immunity 9 years after the fact, having litigated a counterclaim for 9 years. And that counterclaim, by the way, specifically, it does exactly what they complain about, allegedly, that we do, which, by the way, is not true. We have a breach of contract action and a declaratory judgment action. They had a straight-up breach of contract, straight-up declaratory judgment action by which they sought to recover damages. They say, declare that the ordinance doesn't apply, but if it does apply, then we've overpaid these firefighters in some circumstances, and declare that we're entitled to recover money on the Declaratory Judgment Act and attorney fees.
Okay, so what I understand that you're saying then is if they had not done this for 9 years, that you wouldn't be making this waiver argument, and that there would be immunity?
I'm saying that if they had appeared in court in 9 when the suit started and said we assert our governmental immunity from suit, that I believe that the court would be correct to say, yes, you have immunity from suit.
But for practical reasons then, or the prudential argument, some officials within the city government made the decision to engage in this case.
Yes.
And you say then that, which could have enormous billion-dollar ramifications, and you say prudentially is something that should be taken into account.
That's correct. I'm saying it should be taken into account. And in more specific answer to your question, the Charter, Chapter 7, Section 3, says the city attorney on his own initiative can appear in any litigation involving the city and can institute such legal action as may be necessary or desirable on behalf of the city. The city attorney clearly had the right to do what he did.
Well, but why would it be prudential to look at that decision that was made 9 years previous and say, well, maybe that wasn't such a smart decision to make? And
well,
we can't allow that prudentially to affect the city's immunity with such a large ramification.
I think that is judging the substance of the case, which is not before you right now. The question I think that is before you right now is, can a city waive its sovereign immunity and by its actions? I believe that's the question that's squarely before you.
In the city attorney's defense, at the time the counterclaim was filed, immunity was waived, undertook. Pre-took. Sue and be sued.
The most direct answer this court could make today to this case would be to say that Took was wrongly decided and that cities have never enjoyed immunity from suit.
What's your next argument, counsel?
That is the bottom line argument. That is that historically cities, and we have briefed it fully, cities historically do not enjoy immunity from suit. But I'm willing to accept that this court has given them immunity from suit to some extent. But I'm saying it's been done by a prudential doctrine, and waiver is also a prudential doctrine. And if there's any case ever appropriate for finding waiver of immunity, if there's any case that's ever appropriate, this is it. They litigated for 9 years. They asserted counterclaims. They moved for summary judgment. They had a trial on their summary judgment. They lost. They appealed. They accessed the court system there in the appellate court system. If there's ever an instance where the court ought to say, all this activity amounts to a waiver of your immunity and you must litigate like anyone else, this is the case to say that.
Is the fact that we are dealing with 9 years, what about if they had only been in this a year? Does that make a difference? I mean, should we really look at the time that it takes given the process in the court system?
You have to look at something. You have to look at the whole group of facts here, as I said.
So if
it's
they had been in there a year, they wouldn't have waived immunity?
I don't want to to say one way or the other. You do have to look at the entire picture of facts. There's 9 years of litigation in this case. There's accepting the benefits from the firefighters. There's filing a counterclaim and pursuing the counterclaim.
Maybe we look at it the same way you do a jurisdiction issue. If someone comes into the court and doesn't file a plea to jurisdiction, accesses the courts and resources, maybe you should be on the same level.
Justice Brister has argued exactly that, and I know he's no longer here, but he's argued that jurisdiction shouldn't be inextricably tied to jurisdiction. It has concepts that are like personal jurisdiction, and waiver can apply to personal jurisdiction, as you pointed out. And as the U.S. Supreme Court pointed out in the Lapides case, even a sovereign can waive its jurisdiction. Under the 11th Amendment, the state of Texas can waive its jurisdiction by accessing a court.
Counsel, I think it's useful to look at the history of immunity and state sovereignty and the federal government sovereignty. Concurrent with that, this court has been very hesitant to determine, announce waivers of immunity. The argument you're making and the arguments we've heard about the fairness or inequity or the prudential considerations, the voter referendum, the city officials following or not following the ordinance, raise all kinds of policy and policy balancing considerations. The kinds of considerations that's hard to get into for this institution in a lawsuit versus a legislature getting into with hearings across the state and debate and being able to ask questions outside of the record, so to speak, which informs why we've been so hesitant to find waivers of immunity or recognize new waivers. And the standard is clear and unambiguous waiver by the legislature, language that waives it. Why isn't that a good answer in this case?
Well, because...
And if we start down that road, waivers, finding waivers, where does it take us and where does it end?
Your question presumes that the city did not make a policy decision when it joined the litigation. It did make policy decisions. It's made policy decisions all along. Your question presumes that the only policy decision is the one that's made at the legislative level when you make an appropriation or something like that. But it's possible to make decisions every day as a city council that are policy decisions. And the decisions this city council made was to participate in litigation, to not assert their immunity. They've made that decision, and there's nothing wrong with conceding that that too is a policy decision, and that too is a decision that this court should respect. As a decision that the government has made as its legislature, and as Mr. McGarry said, there is a policy decision made by the voters in this case that makes this also a unique case, also a reason that this should be treated somewhat differently than the regular case.
Does your argument lead to the conclusion that every subdivision of the state, every governmental entity, can then waive immunity?
I believe that the court...
Taking appropriate actions without a legislative enactment that's clear and unambiguous.
I believe that the way the court would have to handle that. Cities are in their own area because the jurisprudence has developed for years that they are partly public and partly private. They're partly governmental and partly private. So cities are in one spot. A county, history tells us, a county is a subdivision of the state, and it's in because it is, because a county is formed by the state for the purpose of governing its population, that a county enjoys different immunity rules than a city. Navigation districts, there are many, many districts, but I think that the appropriate thing to do is to look at the Fifth Circuit's decisions, which has a six-part test in the Fifth Circuit about determining whether something is an agency of the state. It includes the concept of whether sue and be sued. It includes the concept of whether they derive their own money from the people or whether they get it from the state. But the Fifth Circuit has a six-part test that I think is a good test, potentially, that this court could look at to determine. But for purposes of our case only, the city municipalities have always been regarded differently from the sovereign. They have both a private aspect and a public aspect. They are private like a regular corporation in the sense that a group of citizens come together and form a municipality. And in that respect, they're like General Electric, and no one would ever think General Electric is immune from suit.
Any further questions? Thank you, Counsel. Court will hear rebuttal.
First, no new law is necessary to deal with referendums. The City of Galveston opinion that the court has been discussing with counsel certainly answers the arguments that both opposing counsel have raised. First, with respect to this idea of something prudential with respect to cities, as City of Galveston says, which is correct, that home rule cities, like the city, in this case the City of Dallas, have powers from the Texas Constitution, not the legislature. It is the power of the people that has given home rule cities its powers. In the Constitution, it's no different. The court has not treated governmental immunity and sovereign immunity differently with respect to cities for that reason, not since 1847 when it first recognized immunity on the part of cities. Second of all, as a result of that, the argument that referendums should be different because it's the people speaking is exactly what was at issue in City of Galveston when the state of Texas tried to sue the City of Galveston. And as the court said at page 473, there are difficulties with the logic that cities cannot evoke immunity against the state because they derive their immunity from it. Both derive, meaning the city and the state, their authority from the people. If immunity cannot logically be invoked against one from whom it is derived, it is hard to see how the state has been invoking it against Texas citizens for more than a century. That bridge has already been crossed. Opposing counsel would, excuse me,
of course, the state is not immune from suit to enforce constitutional rights. Why isn't this, you can't ever change a referendum, sort of like a constitutional right in the context of the city?
Well, nobody's changed the referendum. I mean, I understand the referendum power, and this court has dealt with that before and has confirmed that principle. But no one has changed the referendum. There are remedies if they don't believe that the city is doing what it's supposed to do in the appropriations process vis-a-vis the remedy. On an individual basis, there's the administrative grievance process for individual police officers and firefighters to complain about their pay. On another level, at the core of immunity law in Texas, go to the Texas legislature if there is a problem and get immunity so that you can file the appropriate claims. Here the Texas legislature said no. That's the answer. This court has never said that anyone can waive immunity but the legislature by enactment or resolution. They said no here. So to say there's no remedy in the face of a referendum is not correct. There are remedies available both to individuals and both in, you know, at a larger level. This case on the declaratory judgment action that is before the court is governed by Heinrich. There is no challenge to the validity of the ordinance. And second of all, this court said in Heinrich that private parties cannot circumvent the state's sovereign immunity from suit by characterizing a suit for money damages as a declaratory judgment action. That is exactly what this deck action is. That is exactly what it is.
The Court of Appeals seemed to say that by the plain language of the Declaratory Judgments Act, you can get a declaration. You just can't collect damages on it.
You cannot do that. And it based its decision on Leeper. Leeper is a 1994 case, and there have been actions by the legislature since then which say that there is no immunity for the construction of a statute under the law. And if you look at Section 311.034 of the Government Code, there is a provision that has been in there since 2005 which says, in a statute, the use of person, as defined by Section 311.005 to include governmental entities, does not indicate legislative intent to waive sovereign immunity unless the context of the statute indicates no other reasonable construction. So there is no declaration. This court was correct in Heinrich when it said municipalities must be made parties if there's a challenge to the validity of an ordinance, and based on the Taylor decision said that there was that waiver under the deck action. That is the only waiver that exists under the deck action. There is no such claim in this lawsuit against the City of Dallas before this court.
Address the city's pleadings city pleadings reference to ultra-virus action?
I disagree that the pleading says that.
That it uses the term ultra-virus?
No, not that it says ultra-virus, but the way it has been interpreted to the court. And I don't have the pleading in front of me. Second of all, it was part of that counterclaim, which has been gone for quite a while. That's where it's in the pleading. But it was also said in an if language and in the context of the counterclaim. So I believe my view is that it's been taken out of context.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, Ms. Hankinson. The clause is submitted, and both clauses are submitted, and the court will take a brief.